This is the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie, and my guest today is my Reason colleague, reporter CJ Ciaramella, who has a mammoth cover story in the new issue of Reason that is about the ongoing 250-year-plus-long cycle of prison reform and then kind of degradation, going back and forth and back and forth. We're going to talk about criminal justice reform. We're going to talk about prison reform or penitentiary reform and related issues. CJ Ciaramella, thanks for talking to me.
Thanks for having me on, Nick. It's a real pleasure. And thanks for taking the time to talk through this gigantic article with me.
Oh, my God. Well, it's fascinating because you're not arguing that prisons, you know, just keep getting worse. I mean, what you tell in this story of the American penitentiary system in a lot of ways, the penal system, is that it is constantly trying to fix the last thing that went horribly, horribly wrong. Could you give us a summary? I mean, you start the story at the old Eastern State Penitentiary, the world's first penitentiary, if I'm not mistaken, in North Philadelphia. What's going on there and what is your story about?
So my basic idea was to write a readable history of U.S. prisons, because when I first started really researching prisons and writing more about them and the criminal justice system, I started looking around and like, well, I should get my head around this. And I was looking for a history of U.S. prisons. And there are a lot of really good sort of academic books, especially on the early history of U.S. prisons. And a lot of really good books on sort of the 70s and 80s with Attica and mass incarceration. But I couldn't really find this sort of just broad overview of the history and different cycles of American prisons, which was kind of funny to me because prisons are this considered an American invention. The modern penitentiary is pretty much an American invention, and the penitentiary mode of punishment, incarceration.
And that means not simply locking people up, but putting them in small kind of monastic cells where they think about what they have done wrong and how they should do better if they're ever released again. And they wear monk's clothes or uniforms, all of this kind of stuff that we take for granted. This started as a humane reform in the United States.
Yeah, this was the idea in the when America declared independence, and a little bit before that, they were really working to sort of separate themselves from England's criminal code and the English system of justice, which they really, really hated because it was called the Bloody Code, was what they referred to Britain's criminal code as, because it had so many capital punishments. And so there was a lot of debate over how to do this, but they settled on the idea of this penitentiary or a house of repentance was one of the original phrases for it. We were the first country to really systematically use incarceration as the predominant form of punishment. There's always been prisons since antiquity. We've always thrown people in dungeons. But to make that the primary way that we punished criminal offenders was a unique American thing. We were kind of the first to really do that.
So, and before that, or what they were reacting to, like people might be beaten, they might be, put in stocks, they might have parts of their bodies cut off or killed, right?
Yeah.
But generally speaking, you weren't like, okay, you did this, so you're going away for, 7 to 8 years, and then you get out.
That's right. Yeah. No, before prisons, the primary modes of punishment were corporal punishment, public shaming, banishment, or execution, or monetary fines. And well, the problem with a lot of that was they made a lot of the punishments so harsh that judges weren't really willing to hand down sentences in a lot of those cases. Michel Foucault wrote a lot about this in Discipline and Punish. By having these sort of bloody public punishments, judges were less willing to hand down those sentences. And there were also problems with, crowds either interrupting the execution of freeing a prisoner or ripping them to pieces, both of which were unacceptable to the state, because they were trying
but
to make
But they also, in Foucault's modeling, they also, it was exterior. It was done to bodies. I mean, part of what he's talking about in Discipline and Punish, and he covers some of the same ground that you're talking about, is suddenly you get inside the prisoner's head, so that, you know, we're all kind of our own jailer now, right? We are. And I mean, one of the things that you stress in something like the Eastern State Penitentiary is the code of silence, because it is like, you know, I mean, they're wearing clothes, monks, or, you know, uniforms for the first time. They're in solitary confinement, like a monk or a nun going to bed at night, and they have to be quiet. Can you talk a little bit about why they were not, you know, allowed to talk to each other or even talk out loud?
Yeah. So before Eastern State and the first prisons, we had common room jails, basically. You know, if you were a criminal offender awaiting a trial or awaiting your punishment or something like that, you would get put in this like really filthy jail that also held women and children together along with male offenders. It was really nasty. They were sources of disease and violence and all sorts of other things. The penitentiary, this house of repentance, part of the idea was they were like, okay, we're going to separate criminal offenders so that they can't corrupt each other. You know, the idea was to have a sort of social hygiene where, you know, we'll put people away so they can't corrupt each other. We'll just leave them with a Bible and like they can talk to a minister once a week. And besides that, they will sit in the cell and they will work at a trade like making shoes or carpentry or something like that. And they will be rehabilitated through labor and silence and reflection. And that was the idea of the early sort of the first wave of prisons in Pennsylvania and also in New York, which developed a sort of separate or a different sort of system, slightly different. But, you know, that was the idea, is social hygiene, cleanliness, labor, and discipline. It was
What went wrong with that? You know, and I mean, what I love about the story and what I think people will find really fascinating are the paradoxes of like, you know, so this is better than what it replaced, or it was certainly intended to be better and more humane and more effective than what it replaced. And then suddenly the Eastern State, you know, penitentiary, or, you know, and then the New York model that became known as the Auburn model, like these become nightmarish. But what went wrong with that reform?
You know, things went wrong pretty quick. First of all, you know, the idea was that, you know, corporal punishment as a judicial punishment, they decided, was too barbaric. We're not going to do things like whipping people in public. We're not going to crop ears. We'll put you in this penitentiary. What went wrong was they found that, you know, discipline was harder than they thought it would be. You know, the immediate effects of silence and reflection, you know, not all inmates or offenders responded as well to this as they had hoped. So there were problems with discipline. And so what they quickly ended up doing was reinstating corporal punishment as administrative punishment. So you might not be sentenced to whipping, but you would be sent to a prison. And if you talked to your cellmate, then you would get whipped. The person next to you or something like that. So what happened was you had an almost instant breakdown in order in these new institutions, and they really didn't know how to handle a lot of that. So the early punishments, within, I think, 4 years of Eastern State opening, the Pennsylvania legislature launched an investigation because an inmate had died after being gagged with a torture device. Mm-hmm. And the testimony and other evidence showed that the inmates were put in like a dark cell, like a hole, you know, called the hole, along with being drenched with ice cold water. They were gagged, all sorts of other methods. And this was, like I said, supposed to be this humane alternative to prison. And it's one of the things, like you mentioned, the paradoxes of the system was created with like the really, really high humanitarian hopes and expectations that they would be able to turn criminal offenders into these virtuous citizens of the republic. And instead, you almost immediately have this sort of descent into, you know, pretty typical punishments for the time, corporal punishments and brutality.
Well, I was going to ask, because Benjamin Rush, who is one of the, you know, he's one of the founding fathers. He's a huge figure in Philadelphia. He helped found the University of Pennsylvania, and he's kind of the godfather of Eastern State Penitentiary. So you have a guy who created an Ivy, what became an Ivy League college and one of the most scarifying prisons, you know, on the planet. And he signed the Declaration or the Constitution or whatever. I mean, is there something uniquely American about, like, you know, this is, you know, in myth or lore, this is the place where you can come to be whoever you want to be, or wherever your talents will take you and your effort, and where you can also stop being a criminal and, like, actually become a better version of yourself? I mean, is it linked to, you know, kind of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, these horrible prisons?
There is a connection there. There's this very interesting sort of streak in America where we do believe we're the land of the free, but that also if you commit a crime and infringe on someone else's freedom, we have sort of a really vindictive streak about, you know, well, you're going to go to prison, and I hope something bad happens to you there. You hear that a lot, and it's, you know, but there was this project, like I said, to produce virtuous citizens. There was a lot of anxiety in the early republic about crime and social disorder. And, you know, the things were very tenuous at the time. It was, you know, country was very new. Nobody knew if it was really going to work. So there was a really big concern about making sure that elements of social disorder and social degeneracy were sort of taken care of. And the penitentiary came along as this promise to fix that.
Yeah.
That really captured the nation's imagination. It was... And the rest of Europe, there were foreign dignitaries who were coming right. And visiting our prisons. It was seen as this kind of groundbreaking experiment or attempt at criminal justice at the time.
Right. This is why Tocqueville, you know, he wrote Democracy in America, partly because he was touring the U.S. on the French government's dime to check out how good our prison systems were. That was like his actual function here, which is kind of fascinating. And you quote a bit from the report that he wrote for the French government about prisons. But yeah, you talk about how there's a 25 or 50 year cycle where, okay, things are terrible. We come up with a good idea. We create a new system of prison or rehabilitation or criminal justice and incarceration. And then it fails. Why does it keep failing? Because it's not, I mean, people are definitely learning from the previous iterations' mistakes, right?
Yeah, we do see, you know, throughout each of these cycles, I don't want to pretend like everyone goes immediately back to like the worst, the worst that it ever was. Because after, you know, the way the cycle sort of started is after the first wave of prisons during the Jacksonian era of America, early 1800s, up through about 1870 after the Civil War, you had the Pennsylvania and Auburn systems like we talked about. Those, because of their insistence on silence and isolation, run into really big problems, not just with discipline, but with space. It turns out it's really hard to keep all of your prisoners in isolation because you have to have individual cells for all of them. So after that, states start moving towards more of a like big house model where you have, you know, the long hallways with stacked cells, you know, kind of familiar images. And you also have the progressive reform movement. So after the Jacksonian era, you have the progressive reform movement, which attempts to, you know, reform along with hospitals and asylums, prisons. You have these really ambitious progressive experiments where they want to create maybe prisons almost like hospitals or schools.
Can you talk a little bit about that? Like, you know, they, you talk about a couple of different experiments in that. And this you also see in movies, you know, which come a little bit later than these reforms. But in the 30s, you know, when, progressive reformers or, you know, I'm not sure what the right term is because it's kind of liberal, but you know, it's people who are like, well, people respond to their environments. And if you expect them to be criminal, they're going to act like criminals. If they don't have opportunities, they're going to be like that. So that yields a kind of softer touch, right, in prisons. That, like, what they really need is love and understanding and a craft or a trait, right?
Yeah. So out of the Jacksonian system, they took away a lot of the, like, harsher and really antisocial and insane elements of that, like not allowing people to talk. And yeah, you did see this more sort of humane touch where they said, okay, you know, the goal of the old system was to totally break people down and then rebuild them as, you know, as these sort of just little silent working machines. So what we're going to do instead is we're going to ennoble them. We're going to give them some limited amount of autonomy. We're going to treat them like dignified human beings and introduce other reforms and sort of improve the environment. And you did get some real like high quality of life reforms in some of these prisons, which were really, really awful by the time some of these reforms hit. Like Sing Sing prison was just nightmarish by around by 1914. There was tuberculosis and all sorts of disease outbreaks. And the conditions were just abominable. The Atlantic called it like physically a disgrace to civilization in a contemporary article. So yeah, but you know, they ran into the sort of the same problem where you regress to this mean of brutality. And I think part of it is, you know, because prisons are out of sight and not subject to public scrutiny, you know, the only public outrage only sort of seeps out when there's sort of big incidents or things like that. Oversight is much harder. When you move punishment out of the public sphere, you know, the incentives, the ability to get away with things becomes so much greater, and the ability
and,
to...
And you see that same thing in mental institutions, right, as well. I mean, in a similar way.
Yeah, like the Progressive Era, we see these sort of muckraking crusaders sort of along the lines of like Nellie Bly, who put herself in an insane asylum. There was a progressive reformer named Thomas Mott Osborne who put himself in Auburn prison in like 1914 or 1913 to see what it was like. He was like, he was on a prison committee, like prison reform committee. He's like, well, if I want to understand what's wrong with prisons, I got to go to one. So he got himself thrown in Auburn for a week and then dedicated the rest of his life to prison reform after seeing what it was actually like.
Which is also a recurring trope or type, right, in prison reform of people who, you know, we'll talk later about people like Chuck Colson, you know, the Watergate conspirator who came out of prison as like one of the most impassioned reformers imaginable. So there's also, you know, when you talk about Philadelphia or Pennsylvania and New York State, it's one thing. You talk a lot about the way things kind of went in the South, generally speaking, in the former Confederate states, but, you know, the South more broadly, where prison or incarceration also becomes a means of controlling not just unruly people who might not be showing up for work on a regular basis, but blacks, right? Former slaves and troublemakers and reflecting a, you know, a kind of institutionalized racism. What was the Southern, you know, experience or the way that Southern prisons developed in a kind of unique and bizarre and horrifying way?
The South built prisons, and when it did, it sort of used the Auburn model, which we haven't talked a lot about, but it's sort of basically, you guys, you know, the Three Stooges, the old Three Stooges shorts where they're wearing like the black and striped uniforms and are on the chain gangs. That's basically what the Auburn model was. When they did build prisons, they tended to use that model. But the South, because of its sort of agrarian, you know, agricultural base and its history with slavery, would also operate these large prison farms. And in a lot of cases, these were former plantations. A lot of these are still in operation today. Louisiana State Penitentiary, Mississippi State Penitentiary, also known as Parchman Farm, were both former slave plantations. And after the Civil War, the predominant mode of incarceration in the South became what's known as convict leasing. The South used a combination of like really aggressive vagrancy laws and other sort of petty offenses to target free black people, convict them of a crime, and then they would be leased to a private company. Or a private company would lease them from the state, basically, to work for them. And in many cases, in a lot of ways, this was actually worse than slavery for the people sentenced to it, because a slave actually had monetary value to a slave owner. And as a result, they would tend to take care of them to a certain extent. You know, you go to get them medical care or whatnot. Whereas the companies who were using this convict labor, didn't care about them at all because they could just get another one if one of them died. So there were atrocious mortality rates. In some of these places, the mortality rates were 20-25%, which is about the equivalent of the Soviet gulags. So there was just enormous death and misery in these places.
Was there a sense there, I'm not trying to, I'm not relitigating the Civil War or anything, but, if in the Pennsylvania and the Auburn systems, there was a sense, okay, we're going to make these people better, at least at the starting point, was there that kind of mentality behind the Southern system, or was it more like, okay, this is just a way where we can kind of continue slavery and sharecropping, by other means?
In some of the prisons, there was definitely a focus on rehabilitation. The South did have some early reformatory style prisons. After the Jacksonian prisons, they sort of moved towards a reformatory model. And the South did have some of those. But what you really saw was the evolution of these large prison farms, which after convict leasing sort of ended, they became these almost purely profit-driven enterprises. It's really wild to read about because, the state operated these to run a profit and basically contracted with the prison farms, and the wardens were responsible for filling those contracts however they had to.
And this was mostly to like produce crops, yeah, and a couple of other, items that come out of, yeah, agriculture base.
And it was brutal agricultural labor. They were working 14, 16 hours a day on starvation rations, really, really, intense corporal punishment, things like that. And I will say, though, I think it bears mentioning, I didn't get into this a whole lot in my story. The northern states also used exploitive prison labor in the early 19th century. Like the Auburn model, they would work on factory-style floors, and the state would profit off that. And one of the things that the progressive reform movement in New York did was actually end a lot of the sort of use of slave, or not slave labor, but incarcerated labor and incarcerated market, or labor, markets for incarcerated products made by incarcerated people.
Talk about Angola prison. We're kind of jumping forward a little bit, but you went to Angola and you witnessed an inmate rodeo there. Can you talk a little bit about what that was like?
Yeah, this is one of the, for my story, I did a bit of reporting jumping around. I went to Eastern State. I went to Lorton Reformatory in D.C. But I think the most interesting place I went to was the Angola Prison Rodeo. Twice a year, Louisiana State Penitentiary, which is the largest maximum security prison in the United States, it has about 5,000 inmates. About 72% of them are Black, and most of them are there for violent offenses. Like if you go to Louisiana State Penitentiary, it's because you did something pretty serious. But it also runs twice a year, a rodeo, an inmate rodeo, where incarcerated men, ride wild bulls and broncos. They have horse riding demonstrations, and it's open to the public. You can buy tickets to it.
Had you ever been to a rodeo before?
Oh yeah, I grew up right on the exurbs, right on the edge of the suburban growth boundary in Portland, or by Portland.
I mean,
Oregon.
I was one of the first rodeos I went to. I lived in Huntsville, Texas, for a couple of years, where there's that's the head of where the Texas Department of Corrections is. There's a supermax prison in the surrounding areas. There's a legendary prison in town called the Walls Unit that houses Texas Death Row. And
I was born in Huntsville.
I didn't know that about you. Yeah.
Neither of my parents were incarcerated, to be clear.
Well, I was among the few people who weren't, but Clyde Barrow was there. Hootie Ledbetter for a while was there. I mean, and they have a horrifying prison museum where they had a prison rodeo, I think up until the early 70s, and they stopped it because it was just too fucked up. But what you actually found at the Angola prison rodeo was, I don't want to say it's like ennobling or anything, but like it's a complicated, again, the story is rich in paradox. And it seemed like the rodeo where you could strap yourself to a bull that is going to like fucking kill you. Like, you know, that's kind of a moment of freedom for some of the people participating.
Yeah. I mean, all these guys do this voluntarily. They can win cash prizes for some of the events, and not insignificant either. You know, for the main event, they can win $500 or $1,000, which if you're in prison is pretty much a small fortune. They can sell their crafts at a big crafts fair for fair prices, and they can interact with visitors face to face. It is like you said, it's a complicated thing, because when you're sitting there watching it, you know, some of the events they have, these guys will just sit at a card table and they'll let the bull out. And the goal is to be the last guy sitting at the table to win.
Yeah.
And, you know, so the one I watched, the bull ran through the table and absolutely flattened the guy, threw him in the air. And, you know, the crowds there is like, wow, going wild. Yeah. And I'm like,
and rodeos are intense. I guess the reason I asked if that had been your first rodeo is that the first time I saw a rodeo, I was like, oh, I am amazed that this is legal in a way, because it's insane and intense. And like, you know, it really is amazing. But at Angola, there's also still farm labor going on, right? And is that all voluntary now, or is some of that also still compulsory?
No, Angola has always had what's called the farm line. Mm-hmm. If you go to Angola, if you're sentenced to Angola and you show up there and you're an able-bodied man or even semi-able-bodied, you're going to get put on the farm line for at least 6 months. And that's basically doing really manual farm labor, picking stuff by hand, walking the lines of crops. And you'll be out there in the summer heat with a guard on horseback, a rifle-toting guard on horseback, watching the line of incarcerated men working on the fields. And, you know, it's a really wild image, because, you know, if you swap out some of the clothes, it's really not that different from what you would have seen at Angola prior to it becoming a prison. And so there's been lawsuits over this back in the 1950s. I think about 30-something Angola inmates slashed their own Achilles tendons to protest the working conditions on the farm line.
Yeah.
So it's involuntary farm labor. They're paid, you know, cents an hour, like 20 cents an hour or something like that for this. And the prison actually sells, you know, it sells the produce it makes, and that food and the livestock that they raise goes into our nation's food supply through major corporations, livestock, brokers and things like that.
So. Did seeing Angola in person, how did that affect you? Did it change your mind about anything, or did it drive home, you know, facts or feelings that you already had?
You know, it was a very conflicting thing, because on one hand, I could see how much it meant to a lot of the incarcerated men to be able to do things like, you know, sell a wallet that you made for a fair price. Like a lot of these guys do leather crafts or something like that, or they're able to sit with their families for an afternoon. A lot of these guys, their families come and visit them. They're sending that money back home to their families. You know, so I can see the benefits of it a lot. And it's like, it's very much a local institution. Like people look forward to this. It's a big deal. It's a big deal for the people in the prisons. I came away not feeling super great about it, just, you know, because of some of the events. And I like, these guys are jumping on the back of a 2,000-pound bull with no experience sometimes. I want to make this clear. Like, they don't get time to practice. Right. There's no practicing rodeo when you're in prison.
Yeah.
You just go and jump on the bull. So, like, I came away conflicted, because I felt like there was obviously some benefits that's coming out of this for the incarcerated people. And they raise money for a lot of their clubs and things like that. There's very good things going on. But at the end of the day, it just leaves you with kind of a icky feeling. I don't know. I came out of it, at least.
We won't linger on it, but your description of Attica, the Attica prison riots in the early 70s in Western New York, are really fascinating. And one of the things that's interesting about that is you talk about how that instituted a series of reforms that actually did improve the quality of life of convicts, after a series, you know, where the system had gotten more and more degraded, partly because of overcrowding around the country. You know, but then we come back to this, you know, this moment again of reform. And I guess one of the things I'd like to talk with you about is we seem to be, are we coming out of the age of mass incarceration? Because that, it seemed like in the 60s and 70s, and this is partly a function of rising crime rates, but more and more people were going away. And certainly in the 70s, 80s, to a certain degree, the 90s, people like Bill Clinton, you know, as governor of Arkansas, was tough on crime. You describe a, you know, a horrifying prison scandal in Arkansas from an earlier period, but this keeps happening. But it seems as if we are coming out of an era of mass incarceration. Is that correct?
I think on paper, I would say we are ripe for that sort of time, because what I was saying before is during times of rising crime and social disorder, you generally see an increase in, or a more calls for more punitive justice system, more prisons, harsher sentences. You know, the two big examples during the 20th century were the, you know, there were two big immigration waves and two big crime waves that sort of really shifted American criminal justice. One was the 20s, the immigrant waves in the 20s and rising crime. And the other was the migration, black migration from southern cities to northern cities in the 50s and 60s, both of which profoundly changed the justice systems. And, you know, through the 60s and 70s, through mass incarceration, that was sort of the reaction to that. Now we're in this position where we have really historically low crime rates. We did have that blip there after COVID, where we had that big spike in violent crime. And
for a couple of years.
Yeah, and you saw the reaction to that. People were, you know, really... You know, like, what do? We got to, like, you know, we got to lock down this, so we got to get our police back, or crime's out of control. And now we're just dipping back down into record lows again.
Yeah.
So if the time is ripe for another wave of reform, I think it's now. We still see a lot of the momentum for criminal justice reform at the state level, even though things sort of cracked up in 2020 on the national stage. You know, there's not a lot of goodwill on Capitol Hill anymore towards a lot of this stuff, but
right.
In states,
but the federal system also, what, you know, out of all the prisoners in America, what percentage is in federal prison versus state and local? I mean, it's like 10%, maybe, if even.
I don't know off the top of my head, but the federal system, you know, is like hundred thousand something, whereas you know, we've got easily over a million and. Combined.
Right. So I mean, what I'm getting at is that states can actually do the reform on their own. And you have incredible sections on how California ramped up, you know, its prison building in a way that is amazing. And again, this was under both Democrats and Republicans, conservatives and liberals, like, and Texas had something similar going on for a long time. But is there a sense that not only, you know, because crime is lower, partly because the population tends to be older, but it's also like states can't really, they can't keep building new prisons, right? Because prisons are expensive.
Extremely expensive.
Yeah. I mean, is that, you know, what are the pressure points to say, okay, we're going to have major reform when it comes to how we lock people up and for how long and how many people do we lock up?
Well, the other reason I think we're at a real inflection point now, besides or dropping crime rates, is prison systems are under enormous stress right now at the state level. The vacancy rates for correctional officers have been going up steadily. They never recovered after COVID. You know, New York and Florida both deployed National Guards to their prison systems over the last couple of years. The Arizona prison system has been in litigation for 14 years over medical neglect in its system. All of these systems, because they have aging populations and aging facilities, are getting more and more expensive for upkeep. And so what states are running into is their prison budgets are ballooning and they have less staff to fill them. And it's just a recipe for, like, a lot of these systems are on semi-permanent lockdowns, where they go on lockdowns for months just because they don't have enough officers.
Yeah, that way you don't have to staff as much, right?
Yeah.
It's the equivalent of distance learning for schools or something, right?
Yeah, okay.
It's easier, even if it doesn't do anything. Do you think, does reform come from, is it a mix of like highlighting these kinds of pressures, you know, these economic pressures and these realities? Crime is going down, you know, the prisoners are less dangerous the older they are, generally speaking, so maybe they can be let out. Things like that, pragmatic concerns. And then is there, you know, then should there be an ideological component saying that the state should not be locking up as many people, or, you know, that we, you know, what we're doing is not fixing people, so let's come up with something that's more efficient? I mean, how does the thought, you know, how does ideology come into play in terms of prison reform?
Well, what the criminal justice reform movement did in the 2010s that was really effective was they shifted their messaging based on who they were talking to. Because, you know, there are various arguments for why you would want to fix your prison systems. And they found like conservatives were much more, you know, receptive to like slashing costs, job training for inmates. They had a lot of buy-in from evangelical groups talking about the capacity for redemption. You know, there's like four main reasons that you really incarcerate someone, right? There's incapacitation, which is just get them away from everyone else. Very simple. Deterrence, you put someone in prison so that other people won't want to do the same thing. Retribution, you put someone in prison to punish them. And rehabilitation, to make them a better person. Generally, whoever you're talking to, you're going to, you know, someone always believes in balancing that some way or another. So a lot of this debate is just about how you want to, like, how you want to sort of balance those different aspects. And the dignity and sort of human rights argument, which I, frankly, as a civil libertarian, is where I come from, has always been most persuasive to me. But like I said, you know, there, you can come up with lots of arguments for why we should fix our prisons and put people less people in them. One of the most compelling, I think, is that, you know, even if you believe in things like incapacitation and deterrence, most, like, the research we found is that criminal behavior, by and large, almost completely tapers off by the time someone hits about 55. The former Louisiana Department of Corrections secretary described it to me once as a criminal menopause. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so if you wanted to, you could let just about anyone out of prison after they turn 55 and you wouldn't have any problems with crime. Obviously, there's people we don't want to do that to because they did something really bad or they're sociopaths and we don't like them. But generally, if you wanted to, you could let out a lot of people from prison once they hit a certain age.
You know, when we talk about who people, you know, like from a libertarian perspective, who should get locked up and for how long? You're not at all a prison abolitionist, are you? How do we approach that question of like, we don't want the wrong people going to jail, and we don't want people being left in jail or put in jail for longer than they deserve to be. But there is a certain threshold over which people need to be separated from society, right?
Yeah. I mean, if you look at someone like Charlie Manson or something, he's obviously not going to be fit for society anytime soon or ever. But, you know, our old Reason colleague, Mike Riggs, I remember used to say, and it always stuck with me, he said, prison should be for people who were genuinely afraid of, not just people were mad at, which I come back to a lot. I'm not a full-on prison abolitionist, first of all, because I'm not a Marxist, basically. You know, prison abolitionism is interesting. I think it gives you an interesting framework to critique the prison system and reform efforts, and it makes a lot of very accurate critiques of prisons. But it gives you a totally useless framework for replacing them because, you know, basically just based on Marxism. So if you don't believe in replacing society with a Marxian economy, you're not going to get very far with prison abolitionism, at least like mainstream sort of Angela Davis style.
What do you make then of the, you know, the kind of the democratic socialists of America are, you know, having a moment? And a lot of the people associated with them seem to be prison abolitionists. Is that more of a kind of signaling device, or is it?
Whenever you talk to prison abolitionists, obviously the thing everyone asks them is, okay, what are you going to replace prisons with? And it's not an easy question to answer. Most of the time, what you'll hear abolitionists say is like, well, what we have to do is like improve the sort of material quality of life for people, and then we'll have less crime. It always comes back to that. Like, we'll just have better parks and better jobs and so forth and so on until there's no crime.
Is that broadly accurate, though, in terms of that, you know, I mean, this is an actual question of, you know, when the economy is growing and when, you know, unemployment is down, do we have less crime, or is it really disconnected from kind of material gains in society?
Yeah, that's, you've asked one of the hardest questions in sociology. So thank you for that.
As I was saying it, it's like, yeah, because I also believe from a kind of Thomas Sazian or a Foucauldian line that we also create criminals by how we define people's behavior. So I think some of it is, you know, if you don't have opportunities, you're going to get into trouble, you're more likely to. But also, as societies change, they start defining whole groups of people as somehow we got to remove them from my view because I find who they are, what they stand for, distasteful, even if they're not threatening.
Yeah. Well, one of the interesting things is people have tried for a long time to pin down why crime rates rise and fall, and they've never been able to really show the correlation between the economy or like economic, general economic well-being or recessions and the crime rates. Like, it just doesn't track. The best we've been able to do is more with like demographic trends. Like, whenever we have a glut of like 18 to 20 year old men, crime tends to go up around then.
Yeah. And is that just part of that's because of male aggressiveness?
That's the peak, like the demographic that is the most criminogenic is late teen to early 20, you know, early mid-teens men. That's been, you know.
You had talked a bit about the kind of criminal justice reform alliance that was at various points, you know, going on. And it included people on the right, conservatives, some of whom who had gone through the prison system. I remember, this is years ago, interviewing the former police commissioner of New York, Bernie Kerik, who ended up going to jail when he was, you know, because of things that were found during his vetting process to become the Secretary of Homeland Security. And he, you know, he was a lock him up and throw away the key cop. And he came out quoting Harvey Silverglade's 3 felonies a day. But there were a lot of people like that on the right, and people like Donald Trump signed the First Step Act, which was a significant federal reform about, for people who had committed felonies and things like that. It seems like that group of people on the right and the left and in the center and, you know, progressive and libertarian and up and down, like that alliance to kind of really focus on criminal justice reform didn't seem to survive COVID, as you were kind of suggesting before. What happened? Like, what happened to that alliance that seemed to be making real change?
There was a lot of tension during the first Trump term. Like, they got the First Step Act passed. It was a real hurdle for them to get Trump on board. You know, it was a long effort by a lot of people on the like Republican side of the aisle to get that across. And they reluctantly dragged Trump along. And then after that, you know, Trump started to, especially during 2020, George Floyd protests and riots and other things picked up, and he really started hammering home on this law and order thing. Republicans in general just sort of pulled back from criminal justice or positions they'd been more receptive to. And they sort of, you know, we saw a national police reform movement die on the table in Congress, and that was sort of the end of that in terms of, you know, this big sort of bipartisan consensus on Capitol Hill.
And is there any reason to think, this is the type of thing that reform really needs to be bipartisan, right?
I mean, Congress isn't doing anything these days. So, I mean, in state houses where you see more action, it really does have to be, though, because there's not a lot of state houses where you have super majorities or majorities. So in a lot of these states, they have to pull along some Republicans or some Democrats on these bills. And what you do see is a lot of bipartisan agreement on things like reforming fines and fees, doing things to like improve probation and parole services so that, you know, fewer offenders are returned for ticky-tacky, like rule violations. You know, someone like misses a meeting because they had an emergency. They're not going to go straight back to prison.
Are you, how do you feel about kind of using, you know, surveillance mechanisms, you know, whether it's ankle bracelets or other kind of monitoring that allow people who are in the criminal justice system more freedom to be outside of prison, but then they're also, you know, more surveilled? I mean, what, how do you kind of create a matrix to be like, okay, you know, We're calibrating a lot of different things here. What works for society? What works for the individual? What, you know, what creates less of a surveillance state in a way? You know, but that also keeps people safe.
Yeah, I mean, that's to be clear. Like ankle bracelets and electronic surveillance are a method of state control, and they're a growing one. We have more people. We have, last time I checked, like 2 million people on parole and probation on various forms of supervision. So it is a form of state surveillance and state control. I think on the whole, most people would rather have an ankle bracelet than go to prison. But that we shouldn't just like discount, you know, the impact that sort of methods have. I do think we could send fewer people to prison and maybe keep them on home confinement or, you know, ankle monitoring or whatnot. But there has to be like very strict controls over when this is used. There's a lot of, you know, if you get one of these ankle bracelets, you have to pay weekly or monthly to the company that put it on you. There's a lot of fees and abusive things. So like you're talking about, it's all this sort of way to calibrate freedom. And one of the things that just reminded me, the reason I sort of got onto this whole story in the first place is I was sitting there thinking, you know, way before I ever started writing this, you know, we created this whole prison system to be more humane, a more humane alternative to sort of brutal corporal punishments. But if you asked an average person if they would rather be publicly branded with a hot iron or spend 10 years in an average American state prison, which do you think they would choose? Now, I would put the question, I don't know, you can answer it if you want, but I was sitting there thinking about that. And, you know, the implications of it are kind of big. What does that say about the state of our prisons if you would rather have a hot iron on your face than go to one of our prisons? Is it a more humane alternative? Have we succeeded in creating something better?
You know, you end the story, and this, I guess, is a good final section to discuss, is you go back to Pennsylvania, slightly different part of Pennsylvania than Philadelphia itself, but to a kind of new type of prison that is being prototyped there. Talk a little bit about that, because, you know, one of the other things, and you, I mean, it's amazing the people that you talk to, who, including people who have been involved in the prison system, you know, for decades, and they don't have any experience of anything outside of the U.S. And it's kind of amazing, like when you start reading about how other countries do prison, and you know, it's like, oh, wow, there's like lots of different ways to do this. We take it for granted that whatever we're doing is the only way to do it or is the best way to do it, et cetera. And you talk about a prison that is kind of influenced in various kinds of Nordic or Scandinavian models. What's going on with that prison? And is that something that is, you know, can it scale, or is it, you know, the equivalent of an artisanal, you know, Brooklyn mustard shop that is never really going to be more than, you know, have a very small market, you know, for our audience?
So Pennsylvania has an experimental prison unit that's called Little Scandinavia. They launched it in 2023, or it opened in 2023. It launched several years earlier, but it was launched in conjunction with a couple of Nordic countries' correctional services and the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections. And what happened was a bunch of U.S. prison officials were going on tours to Europe to go to German and Norwegian and Scandinavian prisons to go look at these. And it was set up by a criminal justice advocacy group. And the idea was to say, okay, if you can't imagine what a better prison would look like, we'll show you. So they took them and showed them these European prisons, which are radically different than U.S. ones in terms of the like conditions and the freedoms that inmates have there. You know, they have porcelain toilets. They can cook mm-hmm. with their own sharp knives. They're allowed to have knives. Yeah. They can wear regular clothes. You know, and they have jobs. They can get family. Mm-hmm. They can have furlough times with families. And it's really, you know, nothing like that in the U.S. So this experimental unit was set up to try and emulate a European or sort of reform style open prison in the United States. And, you know, the changes or what they've done there is pretty remarkable, you know, relative to what rest of the Pennsylvania prison system is like. It is the rest of the Pennsylvania system is very violent, very old system, a lot of problems. But this new unit, I talked to a guy who was sentenced to life in prison in Pennsylvania, and he was a lifer, and he had gotten chosen to be one of the original members of this unit. He was telling me how, you know, after 30 years in prison of never feel, you know, unwritten rules where you're not supposed to talk to staff or you'll be labeled a snitch, he was in this new unit where he could sit with a correctional officer and just like talk about his day or play card games, and he could, you know, go in the kitchen and cook food that he had ordered with money that he had made from a job that he actually got an almost decent wage from. And talking about the difference in just the difference in environment that made for him, he was saying that, you know, actually having those privileges made him realize more what he was missing on the outside than just being in, you know, a normal, nasty prison. You know, and it made him think more about like, well, if I was outside, I would do this, I would do that. You know, it actually had a good ending because that guy ended up getting exonerated and released from prison. So now he actually has a shot. So yeah, he was exonerated after 34 years in prison for murder.
Do you think, can prisons like that, you know, actually scale up? You talk at various points, the cost to house prisoners is enormous. You know, it's tens of thousands of dollars a year. But, you know, the alternatives can be more or less expensive or more or less effective and things like that. But could something like that actually work to, you know, shift half of the prison population or reduce the prison population by 50% and have 25% end up there or something?
There's controlled studies going on right now. They're actually doing random samples to see how this works in a average American prison to see if it's compatible. So we're waiting on that. The early results from this unit have been really promising. Pennsylvania has expanded it to three other pilot projects in the state. There's several other states that have similar units. And so far, the results have been good. Scaling it up to a large scale might be difficult in the U.S., but it seems like there is a place for this in low to medium security prisons if this like experiment really pans out and gets good results like it looks like it is. I think it could scale up, you know, for low and medium security prisons where, you know, there's not as much of a security risk. Cost-wise, you know, in some ways, these places require less staff because they're less intensive to guard. You know, they're sort of open dormitories. Europe has a sort of open style prison like, or Italy, excuse me. Italy has an open style prison like this that costs less than a traditional closed prison to operate. So it's actually costing less for them to run one of those prisons than just having their typical closed prison. Italy is a better comparison to the United States. They have a...
And is that because Italians, and we both have Italian blood, is that because Italians are naturally criminal?
Yes, so, the criminogenic features of Italianness lend them more to our sort of carceral state.
Yeah.
They have overcrowded prisons and they tend to be more closed and restricted. So they're a lot closer to the American model in terms of what they're doing.
Is there any connection between the criminal justice or the legal system and the prison system of, you know, do places that have better, you know, kind of legal systems, fairer and more just legal systems, do they tend to have better prisons, or are these things just completely independent of one another?
That's an interesting question. one of the interesting things is, like, in Germany and Europe, they have far shorter prison sentences, right? Mm-hmm. They have statutory maximums on how long you get sent to prison. It was like Andre Breivik, the mass shooter in Norway, got like 18 years or something. I've heard like that. It was like the max they could send them to.
Right.
So I think what's interesting is that a lot of these prisons, they spend more money, but they send less people to prison and have better services for them. So they invest more in the people they do spend to prison, which seems to be their MO.
You write a lot about criminal justice, you know, both about the legal system and about the surveillance state, as well as, you know, things like prison reform. Why are you interested in this topic?
I sort of backed into it. I started writing about the criminal justice reform efforts on the Hill around 2012 or 2013. So I thought it was interesting. You had these like various groups coming together. Talking about reforming the prison system and the criminal justice system, like there was Coca Line groups, the ACLU, and all these other ones. So it was an interesting time. And as I started researching more into it and looking more into the criminal justice system, and reading more about the problems within it, it became this really serious concern to me because, you know, as libertarians, we know that the ability to put someone in prison or restrict their freedom is like one of the most powerful things the state can do, right? This is one of the biggest examples of state power is to put someone away. And I got really interested in how that happens, the history of it, you know, why we do it, the philosophy behind it. One of the interesting things I learned was in the course of researching this is when we first started incarcerating people for lengthy prison sentences, there was some public backlash from families of incarcerated people who are outraged. They're like, hold on, you can't take our loved one away for years. You can't put them away in a prison for years in some concrete box. You know, there were riots and breakouts and state militias were called up in several states to put down prison riots and breakouts because of just dysfunction and anger over this new system.
What are other, if these little or the, you know, the Scandinavian model is one way of reforming, what, you know, Donald Trump, I forget, was it in his second term or his first term when he was like, okay, we should reopen Alcatraz, which even the American Indians ultimately didn't want, right? You know, when they retook it for a couple of years. If Donald Trump called you up and said, okay, you know, we'll make more kind of Scandinavian model prisons. What are two other reforms that you think should be seriously either implemented or really analyzed and kind of worked through off the top of your head?
The issue that I spent a lot of time writing about, and I think that I feel really strongly about is medical neglect in prisons. One thing I would do is get independent ombudsmen and really serious investigations and establishing oversight of medical care in prisons. What we have is a system that allows prison officials to neglect incarcerated people until they die of preventable diseases. I've interviewed a guy who got terminally ill in prison from stage 4 prostate cancer. Untreated and eventually was paralyzed from the waist down and was left to just crawl around his cell in his own waste for a while. Yeah, I interviewed him from a hospital bed because he eventually got compassionate release because he was terminally ill. So that's the sort of thing we allow to happen. And I think it's absolutely disgusting. That's one thing I would do. Second, besides ombudsman, oversight commissions and things like that, I think I would establish a lot more family contact and furloughs for family visits. I think would be a really easy thing to do that would have immense benefits. Family contact is one of the things that most benefits incarcerated people and keeps them sort of steady and moves them along towards rehabilitation or, you know, moving past what they're going through. So that, the first one would be pretty hard. The second one I feel like is extremely easy to allow more family contact, getting rid of, but we're actually seeing the opposite. They're moving towards replacing in-person visits with like video kiosk and video calls, which of course are, you know, contractor installed and earns kickbacks and things like that. So
do you feel like things are getting better or worse when it comes to prison? So, you know, and obviously you have a fantastic, you know, incredibly readable and in-depth history of 250 years worth of efforts. But, you know, is it better or worse, or is it always simultaneously kind of getting better and worse at the same time? Or just
we're
worse?
All, we're simultaneously marching forward and backwards always.
Yeah.
Right now, no, I think one thing I didn't have enough space to really emphasize in my piece was how bad the situation is right now in a lot of state prisons. Mm-hmm. A lot of state prison systems are in a state of genuine crisis in terms of staffing and lockdowns and violence. Alabama has been in a state of crisis for the past 6 or so years. They've been on warning that their prison system violates the Constitution, and there's been an Oscar-winning documentary about it and all sorts of other things. So the actual state of prisons is very much not good and is getting worse every day, basically, until we fix a lot of these systemic problems. What I will say is I think that is in such a bad state that we're going to have to make a choice soon. This is one of the things I say in my article, is that we'll have to make this choice very soon about what kind of prison we want, because the current state is not sustainable the way it is with these staffing shortages, with the violence and dysfunction. It's just not going to be able to sustain itself. Like, correction systems in America are in a death spiral right now. And if we don't pull out of it or figure out something to do, it's going to get much, much worse in the near future.
I think that is a somber but appropriate note to end our conversation on, CJ Sierra Mellett. Thank you for writing an incredible, massive, encyclopedic story about the history of prison reform and failure of that reform for Reason Magazine.
Well, thank you for reading it, and thank you for having me on talking about it. It was a pleasure.